Well, it is time for us to begin according to the bell, according to the clock on the wall. We're so happy that you're here. We've got a lot to talk about this morning. I asked Richard if I'd gotten through my questions. I failed to make a notation in my notes, but I did put a notation in the charts. But I wanted to be sure that I didn't overlook some things, and I didn't get through all of the questions. In fact, didn't get through any of the questions on chapter 25. So we will very hurriedly go through some of those as we do our study this morning. And if you have a comment or a question along the way in some of these, please feel free to express that, and we'll deal with that. Otherwise, we'll use these questions by way of review. In our study this morning, as we look at these questions, I want to kind of introduce you to some things that we're going to be talking about. As we think about the 26th chapter of the book of Acts, we know that Paul is making his defense before King Agrippa. And this chapter, I think you will find to be very exciting. It's the third defense that Paul makes, saying essentially the same things, but a little bit more profoundly. And so we want to notice those as we study this morning. In our study this morning, we're going to look at these questions. We talked about the summarization of each paragraph. We talked about the people. And of course, the places in chapter 25 begins with Jerusalem, and that ought not be a surprise to us. What can you tell me about the city of Jerusalem in this chapter? Randy, can you help me out?
In this chapter, it's where what Jerusalem contains in this chapter is, this is where Felix is asking him to, he wants to go, Paul wants to go back there for,
okay,
for his,
okay,
his half his trial.
Festus, yeah. I knew what you meant. But yes, in this chapter it's Festus. But yes, that's correct. He wants to know, will you go back to Jerusalem and be tried there? And that would have been a ridiculous thing for Paul to have done. He's already been there and had that experience. There's nothing positive to expect there. And of course, Caesarea identifies what in this chapter? Oh, this is the place where Festus is. He's sitting on the governor's seat, the judgment seat, as it were. That's his role to make these judicial decisions. And that's where Paul is before him.
And this is the Roman center of government for the province.
Yes, and we need to make probably emphasis of that, because the Jews are allowed, or perhaps even the word tolerated would be appropriate just here, as we talk about the Roman rule over the Jews. They're allowed to practice their religion, even their judicial system in the city of Jerusalem, as long as it doesn't invoke the taking of life. Now, we know that under the law of Moses and the rules that they were to abide by, the law of Moses did initiate the death penalty. But Rome would not allow them to carry that out, at least I should say under normal circumstances, without jumping through the proper civil hoops of Roman authority. And in that instance, here we have the Apostle Paul. Now, we raise the question, say, well, has that always been consistent? No, they didn't always practice that consistently. They did with the Lord. They did not with Stephen. And you will recall that Paul has been arrested in other places in the Roman Empire. We know in Lystra in Acts chapter 14, and they thought they'd stoned him to death and took him outside the city and all of that. Thought they'd killed him, but without the employment of any kind of Roman judiciary, as we see. Bruce?
Also mentioned that this is where Paul said that he was from.
All right, we're going to note that especially in the next chapter. Paul said that he had been raised, essentially, in the city of Jerusalem, and so the Jews there knew him, knew of his life, knew of his upbringing, knew of the things that he's done, and we'll talk more about that when we get to that chapter. We know he's referenced that before. Now, question number one, what did Festus do when he came to govern over the province, that is, the province of Judea, or Palestine, as it were? What did he do when he first had that authority? Lynn?
Well, in verse 1, he says he went to Jerusalem in order to paraphrase, introduce himself to the leaders of the Jews there.
Okay, we know that he did that rather quickly. It tells us after 3 days. So this was on the front of his agenda as a Roman governor to establish himself with the leaders of the Jews. And, of course, primarily his responsibility, as we've noted earlier with Festus, was to keep, and with, I'm sorry, with Felix, was to keep peace among the Jews and order and so forth in this Jewish province. Number two, who informed Festus against Paul? Who informed Festus against Paul? Becky?
According to verse 2, it was the chief priest and the leading man.
All right, that's the tattletales. Number three, what did these ask Festus to do and why? Lisa?
Requested the concession against Paul and to bring him to you.
Yes, and what did they intend?
What was that?
What did they intend? They want Festus to bring him to Jerusalem. They wanted to kill him. Yeah, they've already got this plot and had this plot, as we've studied earlier. In the matter with Felix and even before. Number four, how did Festus answer them? How did he answer them?
He said that, verse 4, he said that Paul was being kept in custody at Caesarea and that he himself was about to leave.
All right. So he's going back to Caesarea, and what's he want them to do then? If you want to have Paul in your audience, what do you do? You go with me to Caesarea, because that's where the trial is going to take place. Okay? Number five, what did Festus say should be done? Well, we've just answered that. Number six, what did Festus do the day after he returned to Caesarea? Bruce?
He sat at the tribune and ordered that Paul be brought forth.
All right. He got on the judgment seat and commanded that Paul be brought. Now, one of the things I think has impressed me in our study of this chapter is that Festus is taking care of business. He doesn't let time pass. He takes care of the business at hand. He's just been appointed governor, and he's taking care of these things. Number seven, what did the Jews from Jerusalem then do? When they came before Festus, what did they do, Lisa?
Not charges without proof.
Oh, they did. Yeah, many and grievous, verse 7 tells us, which they could not prove. Letter A, we've already discussed that. Number 8, what did Paul say about these charges? What did he say about these charges, Donna?
Neither against the law of the Jews, temple, or of Caesar, have I sinned.
All right. Well, I want to notice that word sinned, and we'll discuss these other things just very briefly. The word translated sin simply means to miss the mark, and we use it in reference to our sin against God. Paul is not necessarily using the expression here in his relationship particularly to God, but he's talking about in his relationship to the law and his relationship to the temple and his relationship to Caesar. As far as Roman law is concerned, he's not missed the mark. He's been right on target. Number nine, that question is, as soon as it comes up, why did Festus want Paul to go up to Jerusalem? Gain the favor of the Jews. Now, do you find that interesting? Gain the favor of the Jews. We talk about politics. Politics is not anything new. Politics has existed ever since there's been government. And so we see that to be the case just here. His desire is to please the Jews, much like Felix when he left Paul in prison for all that time. He had the authority to dismiss the case, but he didn't.
Well, when Felix was recalled, he had made such a mess that my impression is when Festus came, he was trying to kind of scrape it all out and do it right.
Right. A lot of his effort is to try to ease the conflict that exists on behalf of the Jews. So that's true. Number 10, what did Paul say to this, and what appeal then did he make? Mr. Richard. Well, number 10, what did Paul say to this, and what appeal did he make? When Festus said, "Wilt thou go up and be judged in Jerusalem before me?"
He said he's before Caesar's seat right now, and this is where he ought to be judged.
That's right. He recognized the authority that Festus had, and this is where the matter ought to be determined. And you'll note in verse 10, he said, "I have done no wrong, as thou also very well knowest." Have you ever been in a, and perhaps this is an off the subject question, but not really. Have you ever been in a circumstance that turned political? Where, I'm not talking necessarily about government, but maybe with your job or something, where somebody, you know that the person who is accusing you knows that's not so. They know that's not so. But at the same time, here it is, their authority to make a judgment, and to make a judgment rather than look at the facts on the basis of the things they already know, they either wallow around or kick the can down the road or kind of what if, or they don't make a decision or a decisive judgment. And so consequently, you've got to do something else. And we sometimes use the expression, I'll go over their head.
And it may be because of things they've done, circumstances that put them in a pickle.
Yes.
Where they have to, no matter what they do, is going to be wrong.
Well, yes. And we make that observation here. Paul was in that circumstance. He's before a man that appears to be a man of some integrity, certainly more than Felix. And he says, I know that you know I've done nothing wrong, and I know that you are obligated to make a decision, and you're waffling, you're not going to do it. So then, I will make my appeal to Caesar. Now, we've talked about that. That was the privilege that a Roman citizen had, and Paul is exercising his rights as a Roman citizen to his own protection. And I think there's a valid lesson here that if you live in a society or a nation or a governmental environment that grants you certain privileges and rights so that you can avail yourself of those to protect yourself, then certainly that's what he's teaching in this passage. You can follow a process that's appointed by law to appeal your case to another judgment seat, as it were, and that's what Paul is doing here. Who then arrived in Caesarea? King Agrippa, that's right. King Agrippa did. Oh, another thing that I wanted to notice that I don't think I have a question on. In verse 11, Paul said, if then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if none of those things is true, whereof these accuse me, no man can give me up to them. I appeal unto Caesar. We've talked about the appeal and all of that, but I want to note this expression, that if I've committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. Paul recognized his relationship to civil order. He recognized his relationship to Roman law. And he also recognized that if he had violated Roman law and the law said this is the penalty, then the penalty has to be executed, and he would not oppose that. Now, one of the things that I want to underscore in our thinking just here is anything other than that is to seek mercy. When we look at the law of God, no mercy being considered. No mercy being considered. And you commit sin, what then is the penalty? Death. To forever be separated from God. You see that? However, we see the element of mercy, that God extends mercy. Justice is not always what we desire. We desire mercy. And so then Paul makes this observation, that if he has violated the law and the law says this is the consequence, I won't fight that. Now, what we want to note in that and take home with us as far as a spiritual application is concerned is that when we commit sin, one option that we have, and we were discussing this in the Tuesday morning class, is we can just accept the penalty. Don't you have that option? But that's not a very desirable option, is it? What you want to do is to receive mercy. You don't want to accept the penalty. And what we want to note is that the mercy and grace that God extends is conditional. And so we have talked about that in our Tuesday morning Bible class. But the receiving of mercy and grace does not always remove the temporal consequences. Now, I want you to think on that for just a moment and applications of that. But first of all, let's use some scriptural illustrations of that. Here's one. Paul said, if I transgress Roman law, I refuse not to die, if that be the penalty. Paul realized that the consequences, the temporal consequences, could very well be imposed upon him. When we look at the crucifixion of Jesus, And we know that there were two thieves that were crucified with him. And one of those thieves rebuked the other thief because he was ridiculing the Lord. And the Lord said to the one thief, he said, "This day thou shalt be with me in paradise." Now we've all had this discussion, have we not, about people that want to be saved like the thief on the cross. Therefore baptism, they say, is not necessary because God saved the thief on the cross and there's no evidence that he was baptized. Well, what we want to note, two things about the thief on the cross. One is that he was not under the law of Christ that required him to be baptized, because he could not be baptized into the death of Christ before Christ died. Okay, that's simple. So the law of Christ had not been implemented. He was under Mosaic law. A second thing that we want to note is that when the Lord said, "This day thou shalt be with me in paradise," did the Lord forgive him? The man acknowledged that he was a thief. Did the Lord forgive him of being a thief? Yes, yes. Did that mean then that he didn't have to endure the cross and be killed because he was a thief? He still had to die. Now what we want to know in that is that forgiveness does not remove temporal consequences. Temporal consequences are still imposed. And sometimes we get our lives in an awful mess. And we think that because we can be forgiven, then that allows us to somehow benefit or continue the practice of the thing that's wrong. And that don't work. Now, often the application that we want to make of that has to do with moral issues, such as marriage, divorce, and remarriage, and such things as that. And we think, well, you know, I messed up in the past, and so now I can be forgiven and just keep the one I'm with. As if forgiveness removes temporal consequences. And that's not true. That's not consistent. That thief had to die because he had been guilty of being a thief, and the consequences were still to come upon him. He had to die. And the point made here by Paul is parallel to that. He knew that he had lived a life that no doubt was wrong. He acknowledges that. And if he's done anything worthy of death, he said, "I refuse not to die." And so be it. But the consequences, forgiveness does not remove. Now, number 12, who then arrived at Caesarea? All right, Herod Agrippa, we've answered that. Letter A, identify each of these people, Agrippa and Bernice. Now, we've talked about that, and I want you to do that for me. Who was Agrippa, and who was Bernice? Lynn?
Herod Agrippa was the king of the area there, and he was Herod Agrippa the second.
That's correct.
Great-grandson of Herod the Great that was alive when Jesus was persecuted.
All right. All right, that's right. Now, tell me something about Bernice.
She's a sister, but she had many husbands.
All right, that's right. That's right. And so the two of them combined were not all that morally upright. Most scholars believe that they, brother and sister, had an illicit affair between the two of them. And so there is that. Number 13. Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay, we'll try to word this properly. It's a question. Okay, in speculation, you just said that even with forgiveness, there are temporal consequences. Okay, so Paul, when he was Saul, had committed many crimes and persecution of innocent people.
Right.
But on Damascus Road, God chose him to be one of his representatives. So I know in theory where his temporal consequences availed himself, but it's kind of a mixed message if you don't comprehend it properly.
Right.
How would you explain that to someone?
Well, I know that what Paul did, he had committed murder.
Yes.
He'd held the garments of those who stoned Stephen to death. And his journey to Damascus was for the very same purpose, do exactly the same thing. But he was commissioned by the Jewish court that the Roman authorities recognized to carry out the death penalty upon those who were abandoning Judaism to become Christians. Now, was it right? No, it wasn't right. Did Roman law permit that? Yes. Roman law permitted the Jewish court to commission him to go and find these folks who are Christians and bring them back to be persecuted. Now, when we talk about Stephen, that's always been a mystery to me. I don't know the answer to that. We know that the Lord was crucified, commissioned by Roman law, as Pilate ordered the execution. And we know that the Jews, as far as the Roman law was concerned, were not permitted to crucify Jesus. So they jumped through all the hoops. And the mystery to me, and I don't know the answer to it, why wasn't there, or maybe it's just not revealed to us, I don't know the answer to that either, why wasn't there some consequences pronounced upon the Jews for their angry taking of the life of Stephen, and that would include Saul of Tarsus, as he held the garments of those? I don't know the answer to that. All I know is that Roman law, as far as the record is concerned, did not prosecute in that instance. I don't know. But there would have been some awful consequences, and maybe it was because of who Jesus was and the notoriety that he had and all that, that they went through all the, but that's just speculation, that they jumped through all the proper hoops. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But at this point, Paul is standing before a Roman authority who knew the things that he did, who knew what was done to Jesus, and we'll talk about that in Acts 26. He knew that. But why? Why there wasn't some Roman penalty to be executed upon Paul for his involvement in the taking of the lives of Christians? I don't know the answer to that.
So William, having to stand before the Jewish tribunal, and he had to stand before Festus and King Agrippa, could you, again in a speculation, say that was part of the consequences of his sin?
Well,
because God asked, he was commissioned.
Yeah.
But still, in his forgiveness, he wasn't just given a red carpet.
Well, that's true.
He still had a lot of punishment that he went through.
That's true. And we're going to talk about that more in Acts 26, but now is a good time to make note of that. You'll remember in Acts chapter 9, when Ananias is instructed to go and preach to Paul, he didn't want to go. And he said, I've heard, in verse 13 of chapter 9, I've heard from many of this man how much evil he did to thy saints in Jerusalem. And here he hath authority from the chief priest to bind all that call upon thy name. But the Lord said unto him, and here's your point, he said, go thy way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel, for I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake. So, yes, there were consequences that were brought upon Paul, but these consequences that we're reading about here and his being arrested and all of that was a consequence of him preaching Christ. And I think that called upon by the Jews because they see him as a traitor. They want him dead. But this is not a consequence of crimes that he committed against Christians. This is a consequence that's brought upon him because he's now a Christian. And that's an interesting observation. Very interesting observation. Any other comment or question on that? In my judgment, as far as that is concerned, for whatever that's worth, we just don't have enough information to make a determination about, well, weren't these things against Roman law when Paul was working at the commission of the Jewish council and binding Christians and putting them to death and that sort of thing? I don't know. There probably is an answer to that. I just don't know it. Anybody else? All right, well, that's a good question. I'll have to explore that a little bit more. After these were in Caesarea certain days, what did Festus do? Now, that's it. After these, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea. What did Festus do? Anybody?
He
passed the buck, yes. And it's intriguing, I guess would be the word, to King Agrippa. He's heard about these things, and we'll talk about why and how and so forth in a little bit. But he has heard of these things, and he's always been anxious to meet Paul and say what he has to say to Paul. So we'll look at that when we get to the 26th chapter. As Festus relates the past events concerning Paul, how does he say he answered the Jews when they asked for sentence against Paul? Isn't that interesting? Becky?
Verse 16 says that he answered that it was not the custom of the Romans to hang a hangman before the accusers in person.
All right, can't do that.
And defend himself against the charge.
That's right, can't do that. All right, so that's the way that is. What did Festus say he did the following day? Now he's talking to King Agrippa. What did he do the following day? Jenny?
He sat on the judgment seat and ordered Paul to be brought up to meet his accuser.
All right, that's right. Number 16, was Festus disappointed in the evidence presented against Paul?
He didn't accept it.
That's right. In verse 18, it says, concerning whom, when they brought the accuser, or the accuser stood up, they brought no charge of such evil things as I had supposed. Now, what did he find these charges were? What did they have against Paul? Why'd they want Paul dead? Richard?
He said that they had all sorts of charges against their own law and about one Jesus who was dead, but Paul said was alive.
All right, that's an interesting query, and we'll talk about that in the 26th chapter, and Paul raises that question. Why do you find that so difficult to believe? Okay. And we'll deal with that more then. Number 18, what did Agrippa wish to be done? He's got a dilemma. Lisa?
He wanted to hear it from
us. All right, Agrippa wants to hear it. And so he now gets the opportunity to do that. What's the scene the next day? And I've worded it that way on purpose. What's the scene, Denise, the next day?
Lots of pomp and circumstance.
Oh, yes. Lots of entourage and all their uniforms and soldiers, and you can just picture that. Number 20, what did Festus say the multitude desired of him as he examined Paul? What did Festus say the multitudes wanted? Okay, anybody?
Verse 24, that he ought not to live anymore.
And we want him dead. That's right, we want this man dead. And we'll talk about more on that as we get to the 26th chapter. What does he say his conclusion had been? All right, he hadn't done anything worthy to die. No. And so, consequently, why does Festus say brought Paul before Herod? Herod Agrippa.
He has to have something to write.
That's right. I can't send him all the way to Caesar and not have some accusation written down, so I need some help writing this letter. What seemed unreasonable to Festus? Well, that's what seemed unreasonable. Send a man with no charge. And can't very well do that. And I've got a couple of thought questions. Describe the character of Festus. You might even compare that to Felix. Pardon me? He's kind of wishy-washy, but compared to Felix, how would you rate him?
He was at least a little more honest.
Yeah, he was a vast improvement over Felix. But yes, wishy-washy. He has the right to make the decision, and he doesn't want to make it. And so Paul appeals his case. Does he appear to be fair in his decision? To some degree, yes. To some degree, he does. All right, well, let me pass from that and get to... Well, yeah, he's kind of trying to kind of cover all the bases. Okay. Chapter 26. Let's look at our Bibles. Beginning at verse 1. Chapter 26, verse 1. Lots to talk about in this chapter. Verse 1, and Agrippa said unto Paul, thou art permitted to speak for thyself. Then Paul stretched forth his hand and made his defense. Two or three things we simply want to make note in passing as we look at this first verse. Agrippa, the king, he kind of seems to be the head honcho just here. And he's permitting Paul to speak, which we see on a number of occasions. Paul's been granted that privilege as a Roman citizen to make his defense. The text tells us that he beckoned with his hand and began to make his defense. Now, we've noted that a couple of times already, and scholars are somewhat divided in their opinions as to what took place. Some say it was kind of a salute to the king. I somewhat doubt that, but if you'll notice also in chapter 13, we've paused on that point before, in verse 16, where Paul came into Antioch of Pisidia, and here we find him addressing the Jewish synagogue. And in verse 16 it says, "And Paul stood up and beckoned with his hand, said, Ye men of Israel, and ye that fear God, hearken," and then he begins his sermon. So a second time, you also see that, by the way, in these events in Jerusalem, in Acts chapter 21, there in verse 40. Acts 21, verse 40. As Sergius Paulus has arrested Paul, and it tells us in verse 40, or Claudius Lysias, which one was it? Claudius Lysias, I got it wrong. Claudius Lysias, verse 40. "And when he had given him leave, Paul, standing on the stairs, beckoned with his hand to the people, and when there was made a great silence, he spake unto them in the Hebrew language, saying," and then chapter 22, he begins his speech to the Jewish people. Now, the way that I see that, now that's just an impression that it makes on me, that he's just trying to get their attention. He's about to speak and quiet down. I'll address what your concerns are. And so he's making his defense. And that's what I see in Acts chapter 26. Agrippa has given him opportunity to speak, and so he's beginning to address this very dignified audience of kings and governors and so forth, as we make note of that. Another thing that I want to note just here is referenced on the things that we read a few moments ago from Acts chapter 9, Reba, when we go back to that incident where the Apostle Paul is, well, Ananias is about to teach him. You'll notice in Acts chapter 9 and in verse 15, the Lord said to Ananias, "Go thy way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel." Now what we note here in Acts 24, 25, and 26, James, is Paul doing just that. He's standing before Roman authorities. He stood before two governors, and now he stands before King Agrippa, and he's going to be before the Emperor of Rome. So what we want to note, two or three things, is that Paul has an opportunity to speak to those who are in high places. And secondly, just because somebody is in a high place does not mean that the gospel will have no appeal to them, or that we ought to say, well, he's a politician and he wouldn't be interested. That's not necessarily true. The gospel is designed for everybody. And it, as we've been discussing on Wednesday night, when you scatter the seed, that's your job. The type of soil is the recipient's job. And so you sow the seed. And if you have an opportunity to preach to kings, then you seize that opportunity. And that's what Paul is doing on this occasion. So these are things that we already know. Now, beginning in verse 2, he's got their attention. He said, "I think myself happy, King Agrippa, that I am to make my defense before thee this day, touching all the things whereof I am accused by the Jews, especially because thou art expert in all customs and questions which are among the Jews. Therefore I beseech thee to hear me patiently." All right, let's pause right here. Several things. This is just an address, an introduction to the things that Paul is saying to King Agrippa. And in his defense, Paul said, "I'm happy to make my defense. I'm happy to answer these charges by the Jews." Now let's notice that the charges are of what nature? Agrippa, does he know about these charges? Yes, Festus has told him. They didn't make charges like I thought they would make. The charges that they made had to do with their law and their religion and with their customs, and it had nothing to do with civil matters like I expected. So Paul said, I'm willing to make my defense, especially before you. Now let's notice the nature of these charges. As Agrippa is well aware, because Festus has told him the nature of these charges, Paul's reason for being so glad to stand before King Agrippa is because thou art expert in all the customs and questions which are among the Jews. Now, Paul knows that about King Agrippa, and we may not. Some of you may. Why does Paul acknowledge the knowledge that King Agrippa has about the Jews? What does he know about King Agrippa and who he is?
Well, in that Maccabean revolt, they forced the people of certain areas to, well, at least acknowledge the Jewish religion, not accept it so much. And that's what Herod is Idumean from the old Edomites.
All right, that's right.
And he's not a Jew, really. At least he knows about it.
That's right. He's been forced to accept some things. According to the Jewish religion. So his knowledge of it would be better than Festus or better than Felix and so forth. So it is a privilege to stand before this man who has some knowledge of where you're coming from, has some knowledge of the customs and the practices of the Jews. So Paul makes his defense on that premise, that he has the privilege to stand before this court and to preach the gospel, as it were, to people who are somewhat knowledgeable now of the things that he is addressing. Now, we want to note in particular verse 4 and 5, because Paul said, "My manner of life then from my youth up, which was from the beginning among mine own nation and at Jerusalem, know all the Jews, having knowledge of me from the first, if they be willing to testify, that after the straitest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee." Now, this is not news. It's not news necessarily even to Agrippa. Keep in mind who he is. He's had some knowledge of Paul over the years, and his interest in hearing Paul is what's brought this thing to pass. And so Paul said, "The Jews, they know of my manner of life from my youth up." Now, notice how he words that. From my youth up. Now, we know Paul was born where? In Tarsus of Cilicia, which was some distance from Jerusalem. But where was he reared? In the city of Jerusalem. I mean, he was raised there. In the city of Jerusalem. And not only was he raised in that city, but what honor or privilege did he have? He sat at the feet of Gamaliel, one of the most outstanding Jewish teachers of the law and the customs that the Jews ever had. And Paul said, "This is my background. This is where I was from a boy up, sitting at the feet of this renowned teacher of Jewish law." And he said, now these Jews that want to accuse, they know that. They know that. They know what my history is, if they be willing to testify. Now, is this the first time they've heard this? No. If you'll turn back again in the book of Acts to chapter 22. Acts chapter 22. Notice verse 3. When Paul is arrested by Claudius Lysias, and he begins to make his defense now to the people of Jerusalem. He said, "I am a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, instructed according to the strict manner of the law from our fathers, being zealous for God, even as ye all are this day." Now, I find that just remarkable. I want you to be impressed with that. When the Apostle Paul makes his defense, whether it be before these people or these official courts, he makes point of informing them, "I know where you're coming from. I know why you don't like what I'm having to say. I know why you're persecuting me, and I know exactly why you want me dead, because that's just exactly what I did." Now, have you ever tried to teach somebody out of a background that you've come from? Maybe you've come from a denominational background. Let's say you, in times gone by, you were reared in the Methodist Church or the Baptist Church or the Catholic Church. And we could go on and on about that. But that's not our point. Let's say that's your background. And you were well schooled in that. You knew what it taught. And then somewhere along the way, you begin to compare what you've been taught all your life to what the Bible says. And you say, "Well, what I've been taught is not right." I remember having a Bible study with a young man. I say a young man, he had young children, he was married, back there in that room right there. And that young man's grandfather was a Methodist preacher. And he had all kinds of respect for his grandfather, and rightly so in that regard. But as we were studying along, this man was learning a lot of things that he hadn't known before. And when we came to what he needed to do to become a Christian, see, he thought he was a Christian, but he wasn't. He thought he was. I happened to have a collection of as you know, church disciplines or creed books of various churches. I have several from the Methodist Church. And the reason that I have several from the Methodist Church, one was time and opportunity presented me to obtain them. But another reason that I have several of them, dating way, way, way back, is to show that over the years on the same subject, they've changed what they teach. Now, they can do that, you see, because they have councils and conventions where they decide what they believe. And all you have is the Bible. And not a novel thought. But at any rate, this man, his granddaddy had taught him that the doctrine of faith only is most wholesome and full of comfort. And you can read that in the Methodist Church discipline. That's what it says. The doctrine of faith only is most wholesome and full of comfort. And as we were studying along about what this young man needed to do to be a Christian, we studied James chapter 2, as you well know. And we started back up about verse 14 in James chapter 2, where James is talking about the kind of faith that saves. And as you read right on down through that text, you'll note in verse 24 that James says, by works a man is justified and not by faith only. Now here was a young man whose grandfather taught this, and now he's reading this out of the creed book that his grandfather believed and taught. And now he's reading this out of James chapter 2. And one of the things I find intriguing is to just show that to somebody and just sit back and let them process the information. You ever have to do that? And I just watched him, and he looked at the Bible. He looked at what this creed book said, what he'd been taught all his life. And he'd look at the Bible, and he'd look at what this creed book said. And he looked up at me, and he said, "You know what my granddaddy taught me wasn't the truth, was it?" Now, that's a rude awakening. Now, if you've been brought up in that kind of background, do you think that you're somewhat qualified now to show somebody else who is also in that background why you left it? Some of you are familiar with the gospel preacher by the name of Grover Stevens. Grover Stevens used to be a Baptist church preacher until Robert Jackson began to teach him and taught him that that's not right. And Grover Stevens left the Baptist church and he became a gospel preacher. He preached the truth. And he wrote a little booklet called Why I Left the Baptist Church. And it made a lot of progress. A lot of people read it because here's a man who used to be a Baptist church preacher. And he left it. And here's why he left it. And he's just comparing what the Bible says to what he'd been taught all his life. And here's where Paul is. Paul says to these people, I know where you're coming from. I know why you're doing what you're doing to me. Because that's exactly what I used to do to folks that have become what I am. Now, do you think Paul had some credentials before folks when he presented it that way? That's just exactly what he's doing here before King Agrippa. Now, Mr. Agrippa, I know that you're familiar with the Jewish customs. I know that you're familiar with the law of Moses. And these folks who are accusing me, they know me. They know the life I've lived in the past. And they know what I've become. And now we all know why they want me dead. Now, if you look at verse 5, he said, having knowledge of me from the first, if they be willing to testify, that after the straitest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. Now, this is what Gamaliel has taught him. Gamaliel has taught him everything that the law had to say, and so Paul's well familiar with the prophecies and all this in the law. Now, Gamaliel had missed it as it pertained to the fulfillment of those prophecies, but this Gamaliel, we're familiar with him from the early chapters of the book of Acts, aren't we? What was it that Gamaliel had said when the Jews began to prosecute or persecute the apostles?
If it's from God, you're not going to stop it.
You can't stop it. Yeah, if this is from God, you can't stop it. Now, if this is what the prophets prophesied about, then there's nothing you can do about it. It's going to come to pass. Now, we've got to give Gamaliel credit because he was familiar with these things. Now, the application, he hadn't all put it together yet, but Paul has. Now, notice, if you will, further in verse 5, he said, I've lived according to the strictest sect of our religion, a Pharisee. Now, Paul has introduced that before. And we found in Acts chapter 23, before the Jewish court, that divided the court. But now, why is that so relevant? Why is it so relevant in this sermon?
Because he's telling the king and the governor that he did not violate any of the laws that they set, because since he was a member of the strictest sect, it wouldn't even be a part of something that he would even think about doing.
Well, that's true, and we want to seize opportunities to teach somebody what they need to know. But the Pharisees believed in the resurrection. They believed that the day was going to come when there was going to be a general resurrection of the dead. Now, Paul, by making that statement here, introduces the subject of the resurrection that is the hope of Israel. And he's trying to show them that the very thing that all these Old Testament prophets pointed to, and the very thing that all this multitude of Jews that are upset with me about, is that there's going to be a resurrection. And what I'm telling you is that there is going to be a resurrection. And that's guaranteed to us because God raised His Son, this Jesus, whom they crucified. Now, if God raised His Son, that's not only a guarantee that we're going to be raised from the dead, but what does that tell us? He's introduced something here. The promise. That's right. Paul has introduced the promise of salvation in the resurrected Son of God. And that becomes the theme of his preaching. Now, if you'll notice further in verse 6, he said, "And now I stand here to be judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers, unto which promise our 12 tribes, earnestly serving God night and day, hope to attain. And concerning this hope, I am accused by the Jews, O King." Now look at the next verse. We'll include that. We won't get to talk about it much. He said, "Why is it judged incredible with you, if God doth raise the dead?" Well, this is the very thing that all the Jews have been looking for. The hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers. Well, what was that promise? What was that promise? Forgiveness of sins. Yes. You remember all the way back to Abraham, the father of the nation of Israel. God said, "In thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed." Now we see that begin to develop and evolve as the plan of God purposed that Jesus came, was buried, and Paul identifies this, and he was raised from the dead to provide for us the forgiveness of sins. Now on that point, what a grand point to begin on next week. Okay? So keep that in mind. That's where this is pointed. The promise